tonight on Arena. Emma Thompson and Darryl McCormick on their new film Good Luck to You, Leo Grant, and Tulla McKay will be here ahead of her appearance at the Cork Midsummer Festival. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we begin this evening with a real treat. She's the multi-Oscar winning star of Howard's End, The Remains of the Day, Sense and Sensibility, The Name of the Father, and of course that scene, that most affecting scene of Love Actually. And now Emma Thompson is upping the ante once again with her latest film, Good Luck to You, Leo Grant. In it, she plays Nancy, a widow in her early 60s who's taken the decision to broaden her hitherto limited sexual horizons by retaining the services of a sex worker. In this instance, one Leo Grant, played with charm and panache by Irish actor Darryl McCormick, who you may well know from his work on Peaky Blinders. The film is unflinching in what it has to say about female bodies and female pleasure, but also about the necessity of human intimacy and connectedness and the role that sex work plays and could play in the modern world. I recently spoke to both Emma Thompson and Darryl McCormick about the film. I'll bring you that conversation in a minute, but we will be hearing some extracts from the film, and be aware the subject matter is sex. There are detailed descriptions involved here as well. I began by asking Emma Thompson what her reaction was when she read the script, with which writer Kate Brand composed with her in mind.
I just thought it was completely original. I'd never seen these people before on screen, and I'd never heard that story before. I'd never read anything like it. And it was funny, it was touching. It was much more emotional, actually, when we came to make it than even I could sense from the first reading. But I knew that it had to be made, that it was terribly important to me to get on with it. So once we sort of decided that was going to happen, we really moved quite quickly with Debbie Gray, our producer.
Why do you think we don't see characters like Nancy and Leo, particularly Nancy in your case?
Because we're not interested in female pleasure. Female pleasure is not on the top of anyone's agenda, particularly not older women. Older women become invisible, as anyone will tell you, and most women don't really like their bodies because they're brainwashed into thinking that they should be something else. So it's terribly important that we start to normalise what our bodies actually are and learn, instead of using up all our energy, hating them and doing things to them that will try to achieve something that's impossible to achieve, that we'll actually use our energy, our money, hard-earned money, particularly for women, and our passion and our curiosity to enrich our lives rather than fill them with self-loathing and hatred. So Nancy's actually doing something quite revolutionary, and she's a very normal, ordinary person who's had a really decent life, done all the right things, ticked all the boxes, and has realised that that's just not enough, and some of it has been quite repressive. So there's taboos in it that are broken often, and in particular the motherhood taboo that Leo gets really interested in her when she says, actually, I really find my children quite boring, and there's sort of a bit of a weight around my neck, and if I'd known, I might not even have done it. She says things to him very lightly, without kind of, it's not a heavy duty confessional, it's just, I feel these things, and I think a lot of women feel these things, but it's impossible to say, because then you'll become the unnatural ogre who, you know, shouldn't be allowed to live.
You don't have to worry, Nancy. This is just about us tonight. So what is your fantasy?
I'm not sure you could really class it as a fantasy as such. It's a bit mundane for that.
Okay, well, what would you most desire? I mean, desires are never mundane.
To have sex tonight, with you. That's about it, really, for the moment.
Great.
Darryl, then, when you read the script, Emma was on board very quickly. I'm not surprised, given the performance that she and you give in this, in fact. When you read the script and you knew it was Emma that you'd be playing opposite, what was your mindset? How did that affect the reading of it and what you thought about Leo?
I could really picture Emma in it. I'm not surprised at all that Katie had seen Emma from when she was writing the script. So, you know, and personally, I think what kept me in a good headspace was just really falling in love with the two people and really falling in love with what they were doing for one another, and also feeling like the script in itself was revolutionary because I haven't seen any film like this. And, you know, the kind of intention to make it about just two people in one room, all of these elements I found so exciting. Because I knew it was going to really depend on, you know, the two performances and alongside the director to make something special. And obviously, you know, I've been a fan of Emma for a long time. And for me, it was just really anchoring myself in who Leo was. Yeah. And then just trusting that I, as an actor, could bring something to the process as well.
And what about that rehearsal process? I mean, there's such intimacy, and I'm not just talking about the physically intimate scenes between the two of you. There is emotional intimacy here. I look at the two of you sitting beside each other today on the screen. You know, you clearly are so comfortable together. That's not surprising after the film. But when you started rehearsal, you know, you were two actors working together. What sort of processes in the rehearsal period, Daryl, from you first, helped, do you think, get the chemistry that is clearly there between the two of you?
Well, we had so many gifts that I think are unseen outside of the rehearsal space. We actually shot the film in a lockdown Norwich, so the city itself was quite quiet. And we were actually living 15 minutes in this like Airbnb from set. So we would walk together to set, we would walk home together, we'd run lines for the next day. We shot chronologically, so every moment of the film we met, we felt we were kind of following the characters where they were going within the story. Yeah. I think on top of all of that, it was so set up for us to really just grow together as we made the film. Mm-hmm. But alongside of that, I think just myself and Emma, just we have similar humor. Like we joke and we're able to be silly. And I think that was so necessary because the film does go there on certain topics, and there is moments that need to be examined that feel important. But we were always able to enjoy the process.
Was it a longer rehearsal process than usual, Emma? Because, you know, it struck me that if this were on stage, and it could work on stage because it's, you know, it's one location for the most part without giving anything away. If this were on stage, you'd have a 5 or 6 week rehearsal period. Did you have a longer rehearsal period for this than you would have had for usually for a film?
Well, sometimes with films, especially low budget, you don't get any rehearsal at all. But we knew that we really needed it. So Sophie Hyde really made a great decision. She said, honestly, these 6 days are really worth it because they'll save us time. I mean, don't forget, we had to do 12 pages of dialogue a day, nearly. I mean, it was a lot of pages to get through. So the actual mental effort was huge, and the level of concentration also was huge. But with regard to a play, I don't want people to think that this could be a play in the same way, because actually it wouldn't work in the same way at all. Can you imagine if you couldn't get in right into the landscape of the face and the body and the emotions of these people? If you were to do it as a play, it would be a completely different experience, and it wouldn't be nearly so intimate. Mm. And it relies on the intimacy of the screen and the closeness of the camera and you being in your sitting room or in your cinema, able to sort of, you know, watch these two people and feel as though you're there with them in the room.
What would you like us to take away, final question, from the film, Emma?
Release, joy, a sense of comfort, actually, as well, to be comforted. I find it very comforting. Mm. I mean, it gave me, revealed to me my own sort of discomfort and made me feel much more comfortable with myself and my body, and also with a lot of taboos that we live with. So, yes, I think it could bring a lot of joy.
Mm. Yeah, the same. I mean, to see that your intimate life is something beautiful and can be beautiful, and it starts with yourself, it starts with, you know, bravery of looking at things that you might be afraid of, but ultimately, like, we should challenge these strongholds that society kind of can place on what is something that should be so free and liberating and full. So I hope that this film might give people an opportunity to just have a second look at that.
Thank you so much to both of you. And thanks for that, keeping that lovely Irish accent, Daryl. Well won on that battle.
Hilarious. Next time you talk to him, he'll either be American or, I don't know. Yeah, you'll be like, really? Yeah.
Exactly, American. Yeah. It's all gone to my head. Yeah,
it's all gone
to your head.
I've lost it. And you're Irish, so you've got no. Thanks, Dawn. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
I'm Leo. You must be Nancy. May I come inside?
Yes. There are nuns out there with more sexual experience than me. It's embarrassing. Do you want me to brush my teeth?
Oh, God. This is crazy.
Nancy?
It's terrible. It's wrong.
Nancy?
Yes?
Come have a dance with me.
I guess I'm frustrated. Is Leo Grand your real name? Thinking about all the places I should have been by now. No, I simply don't understand why you're doing this.
This to save up for college?
Oh, how wonderful. Are you really?
No.
I've always been ashamed of my body.
Your body's beautiful. I wish you could see that. Everyone wants something different. I don't judge my clients unless they're total arseholes.
I've never done anything interesting in my life. You're the only adventure I've ever had.
There we go. Emma Thompson and Daryl McCormick in a selection of scenes there from Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. The film goes on general release in cinemas on Friday of this week. We will be reviewing it on Thursday's programme. I am really looking forward to that because we are embargoed on giving any opinions about the film until that point in time. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what others think about it on Thursday night as well. Sinead Campbell-Wallace is back with us. You will remember she played Mimi in February in the English National Opera's La Boheme at London's Coliseum. Now she is back in Ireland to play one of the great roles of Italian opera, again composed by Puccini. It is Tosca in an Irish National Opera production at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. Tosca, the character of Puccini's opera, is herself an opera singer. Tell us a little bit about this role, Sinead. You know, she's tragic, she's romantic, she's artistic. What is she not? She's everything, isn't she, really?
She is a little bit of everything. I was just thinking about it today again, about actually how relevant and current a role model she is for women at the moment. You know, she's strong, she's resourceful. She's independent. She's intuitive. She shoots from the hip, you know. So basically, she suspects Mario, who's her lover, to be having an affair. She senses there is secrecy because he's hiding an escaped political prisoner at the time, and she brokers a deal with the bad guy, if you like, the Scarpia, who's the head of police, and agrees that if he releases Mario, she'll give herself to him.
Yeah, don't make a deal with Scarpio. Would be my advice. But I noticed you left one word out there. You told me how resourceful she was and how she shoots from the hip. She's madly, wildly jealous.
Well, she's madly and wildly jealous, which is 100% natural and normal, I think, as a woman. And I think she has every right to be. And rather than kind of brush it under the carpet, she comes straight in. Her first line in the opera is basically, what's going on here? Who was that? I heard something in this room before I came in. So, as I say, she's just straight off the bat. But I think, you know, in a way, that does show her strength of character and also her fearlessness, you know? Yeah,
she really strikes me of many of Puccini's heroines are a particular type of heroine, I suppose. Mm. But she, of many... This is an actor's part. I think Sarah Bernhardt played in the play in which the opera is based.
It's based, yeah.
And that she brought, obviously would have brought this incredible range of emotions to it. But that's what's demanded of you here. It's a big acting role as well as a singing role, isn't it?
It's a huge acting role. I think that's the challenge of it, if you like. Particularly in Act Two, which is this act with Scarpia, where she's being questioned by him. You can hear poor old Mario being tortured in the background. And it's her having to deal with all of that. The writing is incredibly sort of virtuosic in terms of the range. You know, she's going from these incredibly high notes to... He also includes an awful lot of chest singing, which is very kind of guttural. And but, you know, it provides her with that kind of strength and that kind of power of personality.
I suppose that chest voice is a kind of an earthy, it gives an earthy quality to it,
absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely. And she is earthy, you know, she's primal, you know, and it's a very primal piece, I think, in that sense.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think... before you took time off to have your own, to have your family... there was a period when the majority of what you're doing was Mozart and Handel. Nothing wrong with either Mozart and Handel, but there are an altogether more delicate type of music, are they?
It's a different, there's this word, a German word, Fach, you know, so it's basically what sort of category you fit into. So no, Tosca would not at all be in the same category as what I was singing, you know, in my 20s. And actually, if somebody had said to me, you know, you'll sing Tosca in, you know, 10 years time or whatever, I would have thought... Really? Gosh, yeah. I couldn't imagine it. But lo and behold, you know, this is my third production now. And I think it was because, as I've spoken to people about before, which I think is such an important and relevant and interesting sort of theme, is that, you know, once you have children, your body changes, everything changes physically. And so in my case, my voice changed. And so I had to almost kind of relearn, you know, how to kind of manage it.
Yeah, would the range change? You know, would it change? Would there be more of a mezzo soprano, that lower range? Is that what develops? And do you have to pay the price of some of the higher range disappearing?
Not necessarily. Well, not in my case necessarily. I think the middle kind of did fill out a lot, and middle and the lower register. I still kind of kept the height, but I think the main difference was in the timbre of the voice and the power, I suppose, so it became more powerful. It became more resonant.
Are we talking a dramatic soprano here?
Yeah,
we're in
exactly.
That's the area we're in.
Yes, exactly.
As opposed to a lyric soprano.
As opposed to a lyric, yeah.
Nothing wrong with a lyric soprano.
Absolutely not.
And in fact,
no.
the particular aria that we're going to listen to, which is, I think, the most famous of all Tosca's arias, this is very much in the lyrical mode. And it starts, does it start very high or just a little high?
This is Vici d'arte.
Yes, yeah.
It doesn't start so high. And as you say, this is quite a lyrical kind of reflective moment. It shows a little bit of her vulnerability. It's an insight into what she's feeling and what she's thinking. And so...
Vici d'arte literally means, isn't it, I live for art.
Yes, exactly. So it's, she's sort of in the position where she's like, God, I've done everything. I've done everything right. I'm singing for, you know, she's a religious woman. She's very connected to higher power, and she's sort of saying like, I've done all of this, and now that I'm faced with this terrible situation, where's the help? Yeah, you know, so it's a cry for help in that sense. But certainly vocally, it's a more lyrical moment in the piece. Yes.
Renee Fleming is the singer we have in this recording. Thank you. Sorry now to be interrupting Renee Fleming in full flight there. That's Renee Fleming with Vizzy D'Arte, one of Tosca's aria from the opera of the Puccini opera of the same name, and Sinead Campbell-Wallace, who will be playing the part for Irish National Opera, is with me in studio this evening. I had asked you going into that, Sinead, about how high is it at the beginning, and in fact we were talking as we were listening there, that what makes that opening note so difficult is that it's just you. There is no, there isn't even a little tremolo string underneath you. It's pure voice.
It's so exposed, you know, because this comes after, as I say, a huge sort of a fight scene almost with Scarpia. Mm. And out of that just comes this, this beautiful kind of like pinpoint of focus. And I think that's why it's because, you know, this, like, that's Renee Fleming. The Maria Callas, of course, made this role, you know, her own, and she's sort of the most famous Tosca, if you like. So you can, I think sopranos kind of, you can have almost a reverential kind of experience with this aria and kind of, you know, back off it a little bit because it is so exposed and it is so. But I think, you know, that's the beauty of live performance, is that you make it your own. Every night it can be slightly different, but certainly in this case it's everyone is expecting something and you do have to deliver it.
So yeah, I would say Vizzy D'Arte, Vizzy D'Amore, is that I live for art, I live for love, but as you listen to those second two words, D'Arte and D'Amore, they're long and they're drawn, and you can open out the voice into those.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you sang the role of Mimi when we last spoke.
Yes, that's right.
You're heading off to do it in E&O English National
that's
Opera,
right, yeah.
where famously they do everything in English.
In English.
How was it singing the music of Puccini in English? Like, what kind of challenges does that present?
It's certainly challenging. And I mean, you know, to think about Puccini being sung in English is just, it seems like blasphemous, you know, because the Italian is so inextricably linked to the music, and so the flow and the lilt of the language informed how he wrote the phrases, how he wrote the melodies.
Are there less vowel sounds in Italian than there are they more open the vowel sounds in Italian?
Yeah, I mean, Italian, you know, it's kind of the Italian, it basically, you're singing on the vowel, so the vowels usually are elongated, and so that's why oftentimes in English it's trickier, because, you know, it's not, you know, like that. As singers, I think what we tend to do is, you know, you can kind of get around it by almost Italianizing the English, if you like, so that you get that nice, bright Italian sound, even though you're singing in English, which is slightly darker.
Yeah, and I suppose if English is a more, am I right? I think it's a more articulated type of language.
Yeah.
So probably fast Mozart passages, am I right?
Yeah.
Potentially they would be easier in English
Absolutely.
Than a big, long Puccini.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Mozart translated into English works better. Mm. Handel translate, but the Puccini is tricky. Now, if you have a good translation, which luckily we did at E&O when we did Bohème, I'm actually going to sing Tosca at E&O as well in the autumn, and haven't got that translation yet, but I have everything crossed, and I'm sure it'll be wonderful.
Well, if they manage with one, they'll probably manage reasonably well with the other as well. And the other thing that we were speaking about when you were in was you were heading off to the Colosseum, wasn't it? Performing at the Colosseum, Beethoven's Fidelio.
Yes, so that the Fidelio we did here with Irish National Opera in November. The shows were in November at the Gaiety, and I also did Fidelio just now in May in Paris, actually. Yeah. So we did it in Paris, we did a show in Brussels, and in the Barbican in London was where we did it. And that was
kind of coming back after the period of the early years of your children, was it?
No, that was just now. Yeah, that was just in this last the last November in the Gaiety and just now in
Was it the Colosseum then that was the first performance? Colosseum that was the first performance after. I'm just wondering what that first time back was after the children were born.
No, it was actually, funnily enough, the performance that I did first sort of back on the saddle, if you like, was actually Musetta in La Bohème for Opera Theatre Company at the time, which was sort of which is now sort of amalgamated into, you know, as part of I&O. So that would have been the first. So it was Puccini that brought me back, if you into singing.
He's holding on to you. I want to listen to a little bit of Fidelio, actually. We have a little bit of it here. Just we listened to it just before. Mm-hmm. Give me the context for where she is. She is imprisoned, isn't she, at this stage?
So her husband is imprisoned.
He's imprisoned.
This comes at the end of her long aria, her kind of... so again, she's sort of a similar... I mean, strong female characters. This is another one in opera. The character of Leonora Fidelio, she's dressed up as a boy. She's trying to rescue her husband. So she sort of infiltrates this prison system with a view to rescuing him. So this is her, in this part of this aria, she is sort of, I suppose, bracing herself for what's to come. She's determined, she's full of courage, bravery, and she's basically saying, I'm going to do it, I'm going to rescue him, nothing's going to stop me. So it's very hopeful and, powerful.
And that's Sinead Campbell-Wallace in an aria there from Fidelio, the Irish National Opera production that Sinead was part of. I wanted to ask you, Beethoven only wrote one opera. And yes. We think of him from symphonies, we think of him from piano sonatas and string quartets. Yeah. How good a writer is he for the voice now? His lawyers won't follow you. You can tell me the truth.
I mean, it's a bit like if you ask a pianist how well he writes for piano. He writes very well, but it's bloody difficult.
All right, yeah.
And it's really challenging. Absolutely. He makes so many demands of the voice of, you know, both vocally and dramatically. I mean, it's the only opera he wrote, but it took him years to write it. He was such a perfectionist. He rewrote it so many times. But I think the end result is, I mean, I absolutely loved it. It's a bit Marmite, Fidelio. You either kind of love it or hate it. And a lot of people, but oh God, I can't. I mean, dramatically, there are definitely challenges there. But I think musically, it's just a stunning piece of work.
I suppose that's what counts. And is it any more taxing than, you know, because the inclination is to think that perhaps the big dramatic roles are the more taxing ones.
Yeah.
But perhaps musically, something like the Beethoven, or even a Mozart that is simple and fine, it's the simpleness and the finesse that makes
difficult.
It so exhausting.
Well, I mean, I kind of famously, Mozart is, you know, the most difficult to sing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can sing Mozart, you can sing anything. That's what people say. Certainly Beethoven, I would have found that the role is very challenging in the sense that it's a big role. You're on stage more or less all the time, and certainly once you get into act two, you're on all the time, and the music is relentless. Like, it's so high, it's so relentless, it's kind of like it nails you to the wall, and you kind of have to just see a way through to the end. And but a wonderful, wonderful role. I love
a little break then with Tosca, is that what you're telling me? How many
just going to take it easy with Tosca.
Well, listen, the best of luck with it. And people love Tosca, and they love that story, and they love the arias.
It's going to be a wonderful production.
And the duets
production.
Within it are extraordinary as well. Stunning. So the Irish National Opera's production of Tosca with Sinead Campbell-Wallace in the title role will be at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from July the 11th through until the 17th. And you can find out full information on the website bordgáisenergytheatre.ie. Now, I've just asked the woman sitting in front of me, when do I need to ask the listeners to cast their mind back? Cast your mind back to the end of 2020, that year. Yes, that one. Do you remember this?
Well, I didn't see much future when I left the Christian Brothers school. So I waved it goodbye with a wistful smile, and I left the girls of June. And sometimes when I'm reminiscing, I see the prefabs and my old friends, and I know that they'll be changed or gone by the time I get home again. And I wish I was on the N17. Yes, I wish I was on the N17, traveling with just my thoughts and
dreams. There you go, Tony McKay, and that wonderful version of the Saw Doctor's N17 that captured so many hearts. In fact, I see it here. January 2021 was when we spoke about it, which was just after. And I remember Leo from the Saw Doctor's was on with us, and I think it was the first time you'd spoken, actually, the two of you.
It was the first time we'd spoken, and so I didn't meet him at that point either, and I didn't even know what was happening, so it was a whole like surprise, like, but it was great.
Yeah,
it was
and, nice. And people, by the way, if you want to follow what we're doing, Tolu is actually live Instagramming as we speak. Cork Midsummer is the Instagram account that you're doing it on. Right. If, like when we spoke back then, I don't know. It seems to me that suddenly it wasn't to do with, it was to do with N17 as much as anything else, I think. Suddenly you had been, you know, climbing steadily, but then there was this steep shoot up. Yeah. Suddenly it wasn't a jet plane taking off, it was a rocket going up. Mm-hmm. Is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah, that's definitely what it felt like. It just felt like a lot of people wanted to like talk to me, and there was like interviews constantly, which was amazing. But I was not used to that like at all. But yeah, I think like the type of person I am, I adapt to different situations very quickly. So it was fine overall, but I definitely needed to learn how to rest and just say no sometimes, which I'm still terrible at.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say no tonight to us, because you're playing an evening back-to-back shows at the Kino Live, the Kino venue in Cork City.
Yes.
This is part of Cork Midsummer Festival.
Yes. So I am one of the artists that are going to be performing at the Cork Midsummer Festival. And what it is that it's a festival that just showcases art, theater, music, dancing. Like, it's incredible. Like, the top of the top are in there.
Yeah.
And I'm just grateful to be one of it. And also, I'm exploring different types of like theatrical ways of engaging with the music that I do. And I think one of the amazing things that came from N17 was working with the orchestra. And I just can't go, like, I need that sound now. So now that I've been exposed to it, I'm like, I need it, you know?
I don't want a band, I want an orchestra.
I want an orchestra. But yeah, I'm really excited to kind of warp the world of theatre with the kind of music that I'm currently writing. Yeah.
And when you say the theatrical side of it, because it strikes me about a lot of younger artists now that there seems to be this aspect that it isn't just about the music. It is about it's
about a show.
Yeah, that has,
it's a show.
It's almost
a story,
telling a story.
It's an event. Yeah. That's the way I love to showcase my my gigs. That's why like there's so many small like details to it, because there's a lot of time and planning into and money into it, you know. And like last year, I got a taste of that doing Vicar Street and then my tour. And like with all the ideas that I had, I've been dreaming about it since 2018, and I finally got the time to like find the right people, and we worked on that for like an entire year before, like, and then we did it, and we were like, yeah, we did that.
So is this about taking your own music and putting it together into some kind of overall narrative, overall theatrical experience?
But I don't want to give too much away, because I want when people to get there, I want them to feel a different type of experience, because it's not going to be a typical gig. It will look like it is, but it's not. You're going to be very surprised. I even learned how to like sound engineer a little bit. So that's like the gig essentially is 15 minutes and then every 30 minutes new people come in. But you guys are getting the same type of show, but it's very intricate because I'm playing with like emotions and it's very emotive. And at the end of the day, there will be a message that will be relayed.
Okay. I'm just going to take one of the songs here, and you can tell me if it features if it features in one of the gigs or how it features perhaps. Let me take the light, because I like the the light, because it actually, I suppose the emotion behind the light is what's important here. What would you say heading into the features, Malachy? Here,
would obviously. You know that we wrote that in like less than 6 hours?
Wow.
Yeah.
Less than 6 hours. Yeah. Well, let's have it here to what you can do in 5 and a bit hours. Then, Tullam. Okay, here we go.
I've been running through the same, trying to figure out how I'ma make it. Get my mama house or two, booking flights to Malibu, sipping on some mama Henny, grinning by the pool. Now wouldn't that be funny? So I get my head right, yeah, my head nice. Nails on fleek now, and it feels so good. Wanting more from life than I was ever given. Don't want a double living, I just need a clearer vision. Get out one day, we're gonna celebrate and say. We did it. We did it. We're gonna make it out one day. We're gonna celebrate and say. We did it. We did it. Just wanna feel alive. Tryna get my feelings right. See from the other side. Don't wanna lose more time.
Away from this place, we fade to grey just to sanctify fate. Lemonade with a dash of Tanqueray, laughing through the pain, cause I ain't felt the same since they call me by my name. I could quote Marx, but I've broke from my chains. Dystopian he displays, no more soaking in the rain, no more smoking life away, no more hopeless nights choking at the train, cause I was made to stray away from this place. Social norm, I'm making my own fate. Done with broken souls, I ain't getting the dole paid. No more blood stains from rum rage. Well, that put my dreams in a body bag, telling me to stay woke when I'm an insomniac.
Just wanna feel alive, tryna get my feelings right. See from the other side, don't wanna lose more time.
Stuff indeed. That's a little section of The Light from Tullam McKay, featuring Malachy the rapper in the midst of all of that, written in 5 hours and how many minutes? You said under
a
6 hours.
Under 6 hours, yeah.
Under 6 hours. But that kind of intensity then, is that the way you would normally work with a song, or do you know?
Are you
more of a fumbler where you put something down and come back to it and fiddle with it and go back and go away from it again?
So I work in very different ways. Like I told you, I like to adapt into different like situations. I don't think there's any weird way that I haven't worked yet that I can't adapt to. But like, for example, the Cork Midsummer Show, I remember I got into the office to start working on it around like 3. I didn't leave the office till like 1 until I was happy with it. Like I'm just, when I'm like focused with my work.
So when you say you went in about 3 in the afternoon, was it?
Yeah, and you 1 in the morning.
1 in the morning, yeah. Right, okay.
Like, I don't know. I just, when I'm really into what I'm doing, like I don't mind, it could take a few hours if someone's there to stop me, but I could just keep going if like I'm really invested in it. And that's literally how long it took me to do the recording, the set that I'm doing for Cork Midsummer.
And the Malachy track that we just heard there, was it last weekend you were in Carlow?
Yeah,
with Malachy?
I was in Carlow. So myself, Strange Boy and Malachy, we were doing a set on the main stage in the Carlow Arts Festival. And that was amazing. During my set, like everybody started singing Back to Me. Mm. Like they asked for an encore and I was like, I am not prepared for this. And I was like, okay, what song do you want? And then one of them was like, yeah, we want this particular song. And I was like, great, I can do that for you. The band knows it. Let's go.
Let's go for it. What about the set? I don't know if this will be part of the show. I presume it will. Your ancestral language. Tell us about that language and why it's important for you to use it.
Okay, so it's not going to be part of the show that I'm doing, but I do normally do it when I'm doing like my live gigs.
Yeah.
But it's called, the song is called Atuaba, and it was actually written by Tony Allen, who used to be Fela Kuti's drummer. And Fela Kuti is exactly.
Very important musician.
I can't even like use words to explain like the importance of him. So his drummer created this song called Atuaba. And basically what the song means is that as hard, this is the lyrics, as hard as Cocoyam may be, may our journey be softer or not be as hard as that. Yeah. And
Cocoyam being the...
Like yam. I don't know if you've ever...
Is it a yam is like a very big potato. Kind of tuber.
Like hard as well. Yeah. It's a vegetable, exactly. And it's something that we eat so often. So like it's quite poetic in how like it's written, like the poem of it. But the language is Yoruba, which is my mother tongue from Nigeria.
And in the show that you're doing then in as part of Cork Midsummer, trying to tease out a little bit more, you tease me with something on... You said about something that might be seen on the streets, perhaps. When did you say something about that?
Or no.
You said it to me when the mic was down. Okay, so you're not going to say it to me again.
Oh, maybe I'm not going to say it again. but I will say that there will be certain voices that you'll hear in the room, and one of the voices is speaking in my mother tongue, Yoruba. But I don't know, whoever comes, I really want you to like experience it because it's going to be a new experience and I'm quite scared and nervous because I'm pouring a lot of what I felt throughout like the 2020 and 2021.
Those terrible lockdown years.
And I always feel like, especially when we came into 2020, we were really like kind of trying to just forget about it and like rush into getting things normal. But I was really sitting into the feeling of like hardship. That's a little thing I could tease in that.
Right. Okay. Listen, I'll finish up with I can't remember how to say this. It's spelled as if it's I, but it's not. It's Aye, isn't it?
Aye.
Aye. Is that the ancestral language here, or is it just?
Yeah, it means life.
Life. What a good way to finish. Tola, thanks so much for coming into us. Great to see you. And this is Aye from Tola McKay.
When I was ten. I was called for. I was called for. And when I was led to seek the truth, I just fought for what I came for.
The song Tola McKay will be part of her upcoming show at Cork Midsummer Fest. She will be there this Friday, June the 17th at the Kino venue in Cork City, beginning at 7 p.m. running through until 10 p.m. appearing as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival. You can get full details on their website, which is corkmidsummer.com. The Last Spring of the World is the second collection from Belfast-based poet Maureen Boyle. In a mix of prose poems and lyric poems, she moves in and out of her personal history, family history, the natural world and the Troubles before bringing us back to 1612 in the final poem, The Nunwell Letter, in which Anne Moore writes to her husband, the poet John Donne. Delighted that Maureen Boyle joins me on the line this evening. And maybe we just start. The title of the collection is The Last Spring of the World, and the opening poem asks, poses something to us. If this is the last spring of the world, maybe you don't read the opening section of that poem for us, Maureen.
surely. If this is the last spring of the world, if this is the last spring of the world, will we realize it? Will the world know it is blooming only once more? Could we bring ourselves as children again to the level of the earth, to notice new shoots on the hawthorn, the tiny stars of stitchwort, the twining richness of the vetch, the frailty of wood sorrel and anemone? Can we taste the earthy peppers of the soil come up into leaves, wild mint and dusty docks? Will we notice how the seasons have a colour? That April starts with yellow in whin or broom, sending out the smell of coconuts where they'd never grow, dandelions bright by the roadside, shy Icelandic poppies surviving an explosion of forsythia.
And that's Maureen Boyle with the opening section of the opening poem in her new collection. That poem is called If This Is the Last Spring of the World. Your first collection had a reference to winter in it, the work of a winter. And here we are in spring, but spring is usually a time for hope. I sense a little bit of certainly worry, if not quite panic, Maureen, but worry in that opening poem.
Yes, I think there is. And I think the poem was written shortly before the pandemic and when I was already thinking about the climate catastrophe and so on. But I think that first spring of the pandemic, you know, when all our senses were really heightened by the silence, by the absences, by the animals coming back into human spaces, kind of gave it a whole other significance. So in a sense, I'm hoping, you know, that there can be hope, but the poem is raising the issue of our distance, really, our distancing of ourselves from the natural world and how that might be related to what's happening, you know.
And a lot of, I suppose, the style and the way your poetry works, there are these constant references to the natural world. And even, you know, we might think of, well, how can something like a town, because there's another quite long poem, which is actually the second big poem in the collection, yes, called Strabane, which is it 11 or 12 parts, I think it has to it.
Yes.
And this, you almost treat Strabane as a natural phenomenon, the town. This is my father's town, you start out. You give us a little bit of the history and you give us a bit of the geography. What were you exploring in that long poem? Because you bring us right through very, very many different aspects of the town and your family in the town.
Yes, well, I suppose, you know, it's an odd place to come from in some ways because Strabane is often used as a kind of joke in a strange way. And I was very aware of, as a teacher, of what that might be like for youngsters coming up. And I suppose I wanted to actually write a corrective to that in some ways, to write something that would celebrate the place. And what I discovered when I did a wee bit of research was that many of the problems that the town has had, kind of internecine strife, war, poverty, have been there from the very beginning, have been there from way, way back. So I wanted, in a sense, to show that there is this richness in the history of the town. The fact that most of its people came from Donegal originally, they came speaking Irish, and in some ways I think that may contribute to the richness of their language, to the humour, to the warmth of the place.
And maybe if you read a little section from that, from the second part of the Strabane poem, it gives us that link with Donegal, but not through people, but through geography.
Surely. Strabane is in a pocket of mountains. The River Mourne fed by the Sperrins, Knockavoe, Belcoo, Bessie Bell, Crohan, names flowing down into the town too for housing estates and parks. And to the west, the River Finn flows into it at Lifford, its waters from the high hills of Donegal, the gap at Barnsmore, which feeds the flow of river water and of people, come in streams from Gadore, Glentys, Crawley, bringing the old language with them and the ugness, the loneliness of standing in this square to be hired. Most only children sleeping in barns, working for rich farmers. Many would stay and make their lives here. My father's family from the island of Aran Mór.
And that's Maureen Boyle with the second part of her 12-part poem, Strabane. And that's part of her new collection, The Last Spring of the World. And I suppose by laying out that geography in that fashion and that link with Donegal, you get into the social and political complexities of a town like Strabane as well, Maureen.
Yes.
And you don't shy away from writing about the Troubles and that particular period. How important was that to you?
It was important. I mean, we were lucky in many ways because we lived outside the town and we were protected, I think, by our parents. But nevertheless, you were still aware that the town was so bombed, mostly by the Provisional IRA, despite the fact that it was a predominantly Catholic town. And I think the irony of that was felt very strongly even at the time. And I had four brothers, and I suppose, you know, there was a great worry that people would get caught up in it. And as I say, we were lucky, in a sense, to be protected, but it was still there, you know.
You're going to read a little section from one of the prose poems in the collection to us for us as well, Maureen.
Yes.
Explain the word luscus and then maybe read the short paragraph that you have for us.
Sure. So luscus is the Latin for one-eyed, and this refers to a really important incident in my childhood when I actually lost an eye in a childhood accident. So I'll read you a little bit of the start of it. The eyes are lined neatly in wooden trays. They are laid in grooves according to colour, and there seem to be hundreds of them staring blind off velvet lining. The velvet is deep purple, as though they have been laid there bleeding. But that is a fantasy, and the velvet may be too. It was, after all, a national health clinic in the Royal Victoria Hospital in 1966. But my memory of it is blurred and mixed with winter darkness and the sense of a bazaar.
Luscus, the title of that prose poem. Just finally then, Maureen, as we finish up, the book finishes with a great long poem again, where you bring us right back to April 1612, in fact, and the Nunwell letter. This is Anne Moore writing to her husband, the poet John Donne. What was it, and it's a wonderfully intimate kind of exchange
between
the two, well, she's writing to him.
Yes.
What was it that interested you in her as a character?
Well, the main interest in Anne Moore is that she is a blank in the literary history. So despite being the focus of some of the most famous love poems in the English language, we have nothing of her. She was literate. She was classically educated. She was Donne's intellectual equal by all accounts, but we have no letters. We have no portraits. So in a sense, there was that sense of wanting to give her some voice back again. And that was really the starting point of the Nunwell letter.
And a fascinating letter it is, imagined on your part. And something has happened then? She has been acknowledged in one of the libraries or one of the local areas as a result of this?
Well, the little child, she lost a child on the Isle of Wight. And because the poem is her telling Donne about the loss of the child, the local town had been creating a guide to the churchyard. And they hadn't realised, they didn't know this, that Donne's child was buried there. So that's been included now
That is a nice dedication to her
and
that lost child. Thanks so much for speaking to us this evening,
Thank
Maureen.
Thank you so much, Sean.
That's Maureen Boyle there, and Maureen's collection, The Last Spring of the World, published by Arlen House. Books will be available in shops from next week. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7. John Creedon will be with you after the news.